Hello, Boils and Ghouls. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you all for your donations to our fundraiser. We've made some great progress, and it's all thanks to you. We still have a little bit to go, so if you're able, please head to www.helpchilling.org to contribute. By doing so, you're helping us continue to make the world a bit spookier. Now, on to the show.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, one of tonight's stories includes multiple scenes of self-harm. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, and welcome to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator, and we have another triple threat episode for you tonight, with three stories to keep you nice and chilled this Halloween season. We'll open with a story from Finnish author Ron Riiki, titled Viikatiimis, in which our young protagonist has just started a new job transporting dead bodies to the morgue. As time progresses, the nature of his work becomes more bizarre, and it seems to be affecting him on more than just an emotional level. Next, we have two stories from author Mark Taus, beginning with Devil's Ink. Tristan, our narrator, is an author with a very common problem. Like many creatives, Tristan suffers from writer's block, but unlike many creatives, he has a surefire way to get past it. The only question is it worth the cost? After that, we'll close out with Golden Child, also by Mark Taus. This story opens with something I personally have experienced, sitting around a playground trading cards with friends. However, I don't remember being quite as rabidly obsessed as our protagonist is, and I can guarantee that I did not go to the same lengths that he will to get a complete set. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Ron Riiki, I present Viikatiimis. The ER has to transfer people to the morgue. I could actually handle that better than working at Walmart, so I quit. All you needed was a driver's license. The bodies were packaged up, always fully covered, and transporting people, or ex-people, paid much better.
I could survive with the pay they were giving me, even at part-time, mostly because no one wanted to do it. Dangerous, gross jobs don't tend to pay well. Really dangerous, really gross jobs tend to pay really well. It's all because of the really. I knew during the interview that they were desperate, because there was no interview. They just called me up and asked when I could start working. No background check, no foreground check, no ground check at all. Maybe the only check was checking a box that said, "Find any human who will do this." That was me. Taxi drivers have to worry about drunks vomiting, about arguments or being robbed at gunpoint. The people I work with never even breathe. They just lie there, wrapped up in thick black plastic. One of the morticians told me it's heavy-gauge polyethylene, and he said it like he was proud of the words, like he was saying it was made from the Hope Diamond. One Christmas, in my hometown of Raceborg, I told my mother what I was doing for work, because she asked. Otherwise, I would have held it in, like you're supposed to. She told me I was psycho to do that. I reminded her I have the same birthday as Anthony Perkins, April 4. She reminded me that I was born on the same day as Heath Ledger, who she preferred. I told her he probably gave the best psychotic performance in all of film history as the Joker. She told me to stop talking about craziness, that it was Christmas, and we needed to talk about football. I held back from telling her that more people die on Christmas than any day of the year. It would be a very busy day for me tomorrow. We talked about football, and then tomorrow came quickly. On that day, I transported my 100th body. I know, because I have to log every name on a sheet. There were 13 emergency rooms that I would take the bodies from, and they all went to one morgue on an island just outside the city. We'd cross a large, polluted river to get there, and I always felt a sense of calm and accomplishment when I'd see the capillary-like ooze of that slow-moving water. It meant I was almost done with another body. My favorite moment was always the drive to the next ER when I could have the windows down, in summer or winter. Either way, I liked the fake wind. I didn't care about the temperature. It felt, more and more, that I was becoming numb to the world. I finished the shift and went to my parents for one final holiday meal the day after Christmas when we all met, because everyone was too busy to actually meet on Christmas. My uncle told me my eyes looked a different color. I didn't pay any attention, but he insisted. My mother came over, stared at my eyes. I asked what color they were now. "Bluish gray," my mother said, unsure. "What were they?" my uncle asked. "Brown," my mother said. "Pull out your driver's license," my uncle said. And right there was the confirmation. Brown. "Can eyes change color?" "I don't know." They looked it up on the internet.
"It says they don't."
"No, it says they do, but rarely. Keep reading." I asked, "But why would they change?" "It says due to disease."
"Oh, he doesn't have a disease."
"Or a virus?"
"Oh, stop. The internet will have you thinking you have everything under the sun."
"I think you should get it checked."
"How do you feel?"
"I don't know," I said. "Overworked?"
"He just did a shift."
"Before here?"
"Yeah."
"Hauling corpses?"
"We don't call them corpses," I said.
"What do you call them?"
"I don't know. Just my boss said not to call them corpses." "Why? Is that offensive?"
"I guess." "Why?"
"I have no idea." "So what do you call them?"
"I usually don't call them anything, because they never speak."
At this, my uncle gave a high-pitched laugh. It sounded like a broken air raid siren. Someone put on the Christmas lights, and they flashed like police lights on a squad car. We started talking about football. In the following weeks, COVID peaked. Within a few weeks, I transported 100 more patients, the same amount I'd transported in the past few months.
It was body, 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 body. My boss didn't want to let me off to see the doctor, but I needed to. I just felt too different, and that's the only way I knew how to put it. Luckily, because of the pandemic, he was worried maybe I had some weird disease worse than COVID, so he let me go. The doc shined a light in my eyes and told me, "Your pupils look feverish." "What does that mean?" He walked out of the room quickly, like he was worried I had something very contagious. Or maybe it was just that they were so understaffed and he had somewhere to run to. I never know with people. It's so hard to read them. His final words were said to the door as he walked out. "See an ophthalmologist." Before he could leave, I shouted, "Why?" He said, "It's recommended for anyone in their 50s, especially with eye abnormalities." "I'm not in my 50s, I yelled back.
"I apologize," he said at the door.
"I'm in my 20s, I said. He stopped, turned.
"How old are you?"
29, I said.
"You're 29 years old?"
"Yes."
"No, you're not."
"I am," I said. He held the door like he was using it for protection, a possible shield if needed. He studied me intensely one final time, then left quickly. There was a mirror in front of me. I looked into it. It looked into me. All of that opposite world on the other side stared at me. I did look in my 50s. I was sure I was sick, but I had no idea with what. On the drive home, I thought, an ophthalmologist? I had no insurance. The great unknown secret of so many of us who work in medical is that none of us have health insurance. That's the beautifully terrible thing about part-time work. You get no benefits. The reality, though, was that I was working full-time hours, overtime, in fact. But since I classified as part-time, I got no overtime pay. Perhaps illegal. I don't know. I needed the money, so I kept quiet. The next day, ER staff were having trouble getting a rather large car accident victim into the morgue truck. They put him down to take a break. I'm not sure what got into me. Perhaps it was that I had multiple other bodies to pick up, so had little time to spare. But I just went over to the body bag, bent down, picked up the dead body, and put it in the back without any help. The nurses just stared at me. Not a word was said. I got into the driver's seat and drove away, looking at them in the rearview mirror, watching me drive off. It made no sense. I looked weaker, but I felt I was gaining strength. I did internet searches, as all patients do, learning multiple misdiagnoses. I was convinced I had myostatin-related muscle hypertrophy, a rare condition where you inexplicably increase muscle size. I read about the Hercules gene, where excessive muscle growth is normalized. I was at a red light, reading about it on my phone, when the car behind me started beeping. The light had turned green. I would have started driving, but I noticed the driver behind me get out, and he was approaching my vehicle, furious. I rolled down the window, and he started to say something, but then he looked at me like I was Medusa, turned, and ran back to his vehicle. An elderly woman was on the side of the road, and she glared at me as if she'd seen a ghost. She pointed at me and said, "Your eyes!" She turned to a woman near her with a baby carriage and said, "His eyes were flashing." But the woman wanted none of it and just pushed the carriage in the opposite direction. I drove to the morgue. Her name tag read Lorelei Kulima, the only person I ever saw who worked at the morgue. She was there day and night. She told me one time, without my asking, that her first name is an infamous siren in German mythology who sat on rocks and would lure sailors to their deaths. She said this with such a sweet smile, a little flower that I thought was a tattoo next to her left eye, but she said she'd drawn it on with eyeliner. "It's not a tattoo, but it's there every day."
"Because I draw it on every day."
"Why?" Why not?
It's pretty, I said.
It's not pretty.
It's not?
It's practical.
Practical. She slid the ramp over so that we could take the body down. How is it practical? I asked.
Apotropaic, she said.
Meaning?
Apotropaic marks, she said.
Meaning?
Meaning you need to read more.
Later, I did read more. I looked it up. I butchered the spelling, but eventually I figured it out. Witch marks. It was a symbol to ward off evil. Or, depending on the symbol, to draw evil towards you. I wasn't sure which it was with Lorelei. The next day, I said, "So your first name means death?"
"It's common," she said, "to have a first name that means death. Online, I found a list of over 50 names that translate as death. People just don't realize it. There's a lot of people out there who are named Death and just don't know. I met a girl named Azriel, which is death, and a Deborah who spelled her name Dabriah, which means death, and Ernest comes from Ernesh, to battle to the death, and Morana, goddess of death and winter. I've met more than one Persephone, which means bringer of death. I love to tell them their name means death. I like to watch their expression. They finally get to know who they are."
"Okay," I said.
"You sure love wearing reddish brown," she said.
"It's the uniform. I didn't choose it."
"They issued you those shoes, too?"
"No," I said.
"You just wanted to match?"
"No," I said. "I found these."
"You found them?"
"They were placed in front of my door."
"At your house?"
"Yes."
"The shoes?"
"Strangely, yes."
"And they fit?"
"Perfectly. I thought they were a gift."
"From who?"
"I don't know."
"You might want to know who a gift is from before you accept it."
"Too late."
"You look like a walking, talking piece of rust."
"Well, thank you. I appreciate that."
"No problem," she said. "And I dig the beard."
The beard came on quickly, suddenly. It was unkempt because I'd never had a beard before, and when I shaved it off, it just came back, immediately, so I just let it have its way. I actually wondered if I was imagining that I was imagining everything, that even the pandemic was just part of my imagination, that maybe I had died and went to a world that was exactly like where I'd come from, but with disease everywhere, especially in me. The next day, the bridge collapsed. I phoned one of my bosses. She told me there was a boat that would take me to the morgue. I asked where it'd be. She gave me the directions, and it was a labyrinth of back roads, all dirt, so that a fog of dust kicked up, thick, behind me as I drove. I found the boat, but was stunned that there was no one there to operate it. The boss told me to do it myself.
"I don't know how to drive a boat."
"It's just like a car."
"It's not."
"It is. Point it at the island and go there."
"Where?"
"There's a dock. You'll see the mortician waving to you."
"Lorelei?"
"The morgue person, whatever their name is."
The boss hung up. I moved the bodies to the boat with no assistance. I picked up ex-football players who died of cardiac arrest and previous librarians who died of malnutrition with the same effortless ease. Soon, the boat was full of the dead, and I pointed it at the island, and it was, truth be told, easier than driving a car, because there were no other boats, just a wide, chestnut-colored, dead calm river below us. The days were long, impossibly long, as the boat moved much more slowly than the truck did. My boss told me, "Just stay on the boat."
"Stay on it?"
"We'll have someone drive the bodies there. You just pick them up on the shore and take them to wherever it is you take them."
"The morgue."
"Wherever."
"So I'm only on the boat now?"
"Yes."
"From when to when?"
"When to when?
What hours?"
"We need you 24/7 right now. There's just too many bodies."
"I'm part-time."
"Now you're full..."
"With overtime?"
Anything you want. You're all we got. There's bodies on the shore waiting for you right now.
Now?
Now.
Where?
On the shore.
There's fog everywhere.
Go to the shore. You'll see them.
I went to the shore. The bodies were there, lined up, for me. Whoever did it was gone. I did this for forever, it seemed like. Hours passing, days passing, weeks, months. I grew gaunt. It was impossible to eat, no restaurants anywhere nearby, so that Lorelei shared her food with me, meals she'd prepared before her shift. Kilma porua, cold porridge, and kalikuko, fish bread. She was always there when I arrived, on the dock, a dog growling in the background, hidden by the fog. I had no idea when she went on break or when she was off duty. She was always just there, earning overtime too. I thought we'd both be rich by the end of this. The end of what? I didn't know. The boat engine stopped working. There was an oar on board. I used it. It was like battling death to get across that way, but I was persistent. It was the same pay either way. I was never rushed. The bodies weren't either. They just lied there, all around me, patient. I kept losing weight from all the work. You could literally see my bones. Lorelei said,
"Your face is a skull. Eat."
She slid salmiakki over towards me, the blackest licorice imaginable, salted. I ate it, and my teeth turned midnight. She filled my pockets with it.
"Too many bodies to get to," I said.
I disappeared into the fog. Eventually, Lorelei left me a note on the dock addressed to Vika Timis, her new nickname for me. I was to leave the bodies there. She'd get them when she could. I wouldn't be seeing her anymore either. Would just hear the dog growling so much that it sounded like two dogs, fog-shadowed. And I would go through the fog, collect the bodies, float through the fog again, drop the bodies off on the dock, and continue. I would do this over and over, no interaction with anybody except for the bodies. There was one brief moment when the fog cleared where I looked over the edge of the boat and saw my reflection in the water, my ears so pointed, and my skull so cloud white. And the wings that I'd grown, so massive, so strong as hammers. How all the dead would admire them, as the living admire the sun. You've been listening to Vika Timis by Ron Reiki. And now, from Mark Taus, I give you Devil's Ink. It's been nearly 4 weeks since I last put pen to paper. Each day that passes, the disconnect seems to grow, and I'm worried I might not find a way back. Ellie says it's because I'm locking myself away from life. She challenges me. How can the promising new find, Tristan Kowalski, conjure new worlds if he doesn't even acknowledge his own? The last time Ellie visited, I told her not to come back, that I needed space. She may be happy enough swimming in mediocrity with only minor flashes of anything credible, but I'm not. Sacrifices must be made. The view is usually enough to inspire. Rolling hills, decrepit farm buildings, skies that carry a bounty of orange and gold endlessly stretching into the distance. Yet, here I am, pen in hand and a head full of second-rate ideas to embarrass me. Of late, I don't feel worthy of the pen, as though its beauty undermines me. Solid gold, ornately decorated with all sorts of otherworldly scenes, and the words, "For Tristan," etched down one side. We've done great work together, but now I find myself clasping it tightly like a weapon rather than a tool, full of rage and impatience. I have nothing. Nothing. Slamming my fist into the desk, I let out a scream,
A wild, maniacal cry of hopeless desperation that echoes through the house. Even the crows outside take flight, cawing their noisy disapproval. And it happens, just like that. A moment of unequivocal clarity. It's as though the crows have lifted the veil of bile and fogginess that has been shrouding my brain in recent weeks. The idea is forming. I can feel the adrenaline kicking in, heart rate increasing, goosebumps randomly prickling across my skin, and the pen shaking in my grasp. As if on cue, a haunting wind whistles across the front of the house. The rotting sash windows gently rattle in their frames, and through the glass, I watch the dark clouds roll in impossibly quickly, swallowing sunlight and the innocence of day. It's a much more sinister scene, and it sends a shudder down my spine. I've felt this before, a sudden shift of energy, but not like this, never this powerful. It's as though something is here with me. Nestled between the bandages, painkillers, anticoagulants, and medical tape is the confronting but exhilarating sight of the fresh steel blade. Hand still shaking, I purse my fingers around it and delicately roll up my left sleeve. Partially healed wounds from my last success still appear sore, and the entire arm is still tender to touch, nerve endings screaming in protest as I tentatively search for unblemished areas. I try the other arm, but hard scar tissue weaves its way from the wrist to bicep. Needlework isn't a strong point of mine. Unbuckling my belt, I slide it from around my waist and undo the button of my pants. They fall to the ground, revealing more of my handiwork. Finally, I find some untouched flesh on the underside of my thigh and ready myself, doubling up the belt and placing it between my teeth. "Why do you insist on using red ink?" my publisher once asked. I was taken to the edge with the last story. Couldn't tell you how much blood I poured into that one, but it was worth it. I know how far I can go and which veins to avoid. The familiar bitter earthiness of the belt gathers at the back of my throat as I try to steady my hand. 3, 2, 1. I run the blade across my thigh and wince at the slightly delayed pain, watching as the crimson begins to trickle down my pale skin. Pushing it further in, I twist the blade, biting down hard as pulses of torment vibrate down my leg. Christ above! Deep breaths, Tristan. Look beyond the pain and think of what you're achieving. I dip the pen into the beautiful redness and quickly begin to scribe the first few words across the paper. Relief is immediate as the taunting blankness gives way to lines of prose that make me want to laugh and cry. I'm in the zone, on a roll. Unstoppable. I'm not insane. This is no ordinary pen, you see. It was a gift left for me on my bedside table, perhaps by the same entity here with me now. I can't recall much about her appearance other than the yellow eyes and black cloak, but her words resonated with me. It must be nearly 10 years since she visited me in my sleep, telling me how much she admired my work. Her only critique was that my stories could often feel detached, full of redundant words and superficial ramblings rather than accurate depictions of a character's actions or emotional state. "You are doing yourself an injustice," she had said. She told me the pen was magic, that it would change my life forever. There were rules, though. It must be human blood, freshly drawn to be effective, and I could only moderate the pain with household painkillers. Anything beyond this would tarnish the emotional rawness and overall effectiveness. The blood would provide a life source for the pen that would take it beyond simple calligraphy, enchanting it with an intuition that would know what to write even before I could conjure the words. All I needed was the idea, and the pen would do the rest, allowing my characters to bleed onto the paper. I've already filled 4 pages, but I want to make sure I can set a maintainable pace. I wrap some tape around my wound and relax back into the chair,
watching as the clouds begin to roll back. A morsel of light finds its way through the grimy window as I break off some bread and wash four painkillers down with a glass of Chianti. It almost feels as though the presence has left now that I have stopped writing. I don't need to reread my work. It is perfection. And when I'm finished with this one, everyone will know who Tristan Kowalski is. My leg pulsates with a satisfying dull throb, but for me, pain means productivity. It means I'm working and creating, that I'm happy. I knock back the wine and pour another glass. Here's to the one they will remember forever, I toast. Startled, I wake up in the chair, throat dry, my neck stiff. Grabbing my wooden cane, I push myself to my feet and hobble carefully to the bathroom. My face is free of cuts, but tired-looking. Pale skin with a tinge of yellow, dark circles and sunken eyes. I carefully lift the gauze to inspect the wound. It shouldn't be too painful to reopen. After splashing my face with cold water, I return to my desk and slowly ease into the chair. Almost immediately, morning light fades. As I work the blade back into my skin, teeth clenched, the brighter blood begins to spill over the darkened surface. I can't afford to waste a drop, so I quickly gather the pen and dip it in. And I'm off. I have often asked myself if it is cheating, but all the magic pen does is bring out what's already inside of me. I come up with the idea, and the pen only helps in the transition from mind to paper. Besides, something this arduous and painful surely could not be considered cheating. I was gifted this by someone, or something, who believed in me. What am I to do? Paragraph after paragraph, page after page, I write as though trying to rid my mind of bile. I've no idea what time it is, clouds remaining consistently gray, the clock in pieces at my feet. How many painkillers have I taken? I've no clue. All I know is the emotional charge jumping from the page transcends any of the pain. Six wounds gape open on my right leg, but there is a detachment, as though I'm on a different plane. So much for pacing myself. I'm halfway through the story, but I'm growing weary. I've started to see things, shadows lurking in the dingy corners of the room, and in the middle of the field, the scarecrow appears to be slowly rotating. I wake up to see a pool of semi-congealed blood surrounding the chair. Shit, how much blood have I wasted? Why the fuck didn't I wrap my wounds? I have to be on top of this, otherwise I won't make it. Pain is sharp but manageable. Six painkillers should do it. Any more would make my attempts at writing futile. I can only rely on the pen so much. My body is sluggish, heavy, and unresponsive. But if I work all day, perhaps I can finish this dark tale. Groans emerge from my stomach, but any hunger pangs are overridden by the tremendous pain that rips down my leg as I raise myself from the chair. Carefully, I strip off my blood-soaked clothes, grimacing with each move. I'm numb to the devastation I've inflicted on my body, but scar tissue across my skin means prostitutes demand a premium. Don't judge me. My love is for my work, and sacrifices must be made. I grab the blade and urgently survey the uneven landscape of my skin until I find an untouched clearing. With the belt between my teeth once more, I rip through the right side of my abdomen and release a garbled, muffled scream. Fuck! The blood comes out fast. I think I've gone too deep. No time to waste. I grab the pen and go to work, paying no heed to the rattles of the windows or the darkness that wraps itself around the house. A complexity of emotions flows onto the paper. Nothing is lost in translation as the pen dances across the pages, bringing heartache and despair to these real people I have created. I feel it all, and I know the reader will too. Not one mistake, no edits required. A flawless account of darkness. Wait, what was that? Something in the room? More shadows? The words on the page begin to drift in and out of focus. I feel lightheaded. No, not now. Everywhere I look, I see my blood, fresh, congealed, in between. So much of it. Has my urgency made me careless? I must finish it today, though. Then I can heal, rest, bask in the inevitable glory. I carry on. Nobody said it would be easy. The scratching on the paper is no longer satisfying. Each stroke feels as though I'm drawing the sharp nib across my nerve endings. My body screams at me to stop, but the composition continues. Tears roll down my cheek as I continue to scrawl, a combination of pain and the beauty of the prose that spills. I'm so close now. My mind is starting to play tricks on me. The paper replaced with human skin, and the scarecrow outside appears to be getting closer each time. Is it smiling? There's a cacophony of crows, but I can't see any through the window. I sink the pen into my chest and grimace at the raw pain that lights me up. My arms feel weak now, and it hurts to hold the pen, but the words carry on. Eyes closing, body throbbing, the final chapter is shaping up nicely. I'm drifting in and out of consciousness, but the ending is coming together in heart-rending scenes of exquisite distress. A couple more pages, and I should be. The crows wake me. I must have passed out again. They scream in my head like some twisted alarm I can't turn off. Come on! My body wants to give up, switch off, but the partnership continues, the pen narrating my inner darkness. These characters are self-destructing, their hate eating them from the inside. And it's magical. So close. I'm on the last page. This is where it ends. Is that in my head? The low hum of an engine above the cause. It's getting louder. Must focus. But fuck, I feel as though I'm losing it. Words still flow, but each one is becoming more laborious. I'm struggling to keep pace. The sheet of paper seems impossibly far away. Black spots dance in front of my eyes in rhythm to the pulsating pain. Shadows float across my vision, and that mysterious presence feels ever stronger, and the crows so impossibly loud. A thundering knock on the door startles me. My imagination? No. As if in agreement, the crows instantly cease their cries and the shadows leave.
Tristan?
The voice is slow and distorted, but I still recognize it as Ellie's. No, go away. Why did the jealous bitch have to come now? Another knock.
Tristan, I know you're in there.
Please leave. I'm so weak. I'm not sure how long I can keep going. The sound of crunching gravel brings some relief. She's leaving. I try to regroup for the final push, but she's at the window, her face drawn back in concern and disgust.
Tristan!
She screams, running down the side of the house. The door. Fuck, I don't think it's locked. Within seconds, it swings open. I scowl at her unwelcome presence. Cavernous lines eat into her bloodless face as she cries,
What have you done?
It's fine. I'm nearly finished, I say impatiently.
You need a hospital. You're a mess.
She wraps an arm around my shoulder as if to escort me away, but only manages to partially turn the chair. Leave me alone.
Look at the blood,
she asserts.
You're going to die.
Fuck off! My lips curl back around my teeth.
I'm calling an ambulance,
she says. My tolerance is exhausted. As she momentarily releases her grip to reach into her handbag, I swing the pen with as much force as I can muster into her neck. Instinctively, she reaches towards her throat with little facial reaction, but as the shock and realization kick in, she drops to her knees, eyes wide and full of terror. Whimpering follows. No rage, no screams, just a series of pathetic moans. Muted disbelief projects from her eyes, and I can only imagine the internal rush of thoughts in her head that throw her mortality into question. She wraps her fingers around the pen and rips it out, creating a fountain of blood that sprays to the floor below. I watch her body topple over into the shallow pool of crimson, wincing at the thud of her head on the floor. A lengthy and horrific gurgle leaves her lips as she squirms in our combined cocktail of blood until a heavy silence blankets the room. Without hesitation, I reach for the pen, grimacing at the waves of pain that rush over me. I've lost too much blood. Ellie was right. I'm going to die. The words start to flow once again as the crows pick up their raucous tune. There's a stench in the room, too, perhaps the smell of my imminent death. But I'm down to the last paragraph. Nothing can stop me now. The shadows that fill my vision are becoming more aggressive, more restless, as though excited about the imminent climax of the tale. Forcing my eyes to remain open as my entire body vibrates with a raw sensitivity, I write the first few words of the ending. More tears break through as the story nears its harrowing conclusion. The smell is getting worse, putrid, like nothing I've experienced before. Sinister darkness fills the room that I know can't be attributed to the clouds alone. Urgently, I dip the pen back into Ellie's neck and begin the final sentence. Shadows peel away from the walls, surrounding me in a series of black clouds that aggressively splinter into smaller ones and regroup. An oppressive heaviness weighs down on me. Is this what dying feels like? I push on with the final few words. It will be finished. And out of the black mist steps the familiar figure, hooded black cloak draping across her human form. Yellow eyes on me, but only darkness surrounding them. Finish, her low, guttural voice prompts. My life is dwindling away. I can feel it. But as I write the last few words, I cannot help but smile. I've done it. My masterpiece. The end, I announce. It's been a long time, Tristan, the entity says. It's perfect, is all I can conjure. Perfect. Do you know who I am? The pen. You gave me the magic pen. I did, she says, but it isn't magic. What? What are you talking about? How else can I induce such passion and intensity without raising the stakes? She replies. It's not magic. It's just a pen. You wrote this, felt this, bled this. No words wasted. No redundant branches of prose. I've been here with you, watching your newfound mastery of words. You're ready now.
But why did you lie? And ready for what?
I am the devil, and I lie. I just had to be sure you were the one.
The crows are back, but this time I can see them. They're in my room, fluttering wildly above our heads. You see, I need a writer, someone to document my work, to portray the fear and torment I create. God has the Bible, but I have nothing. You will be my writer,
and together we will make history. Piercing caws emerge from the crows as they launch into aggressive swoops, like vultures impatiently waiting for their dying prey. My heart rate slows, my life ebbing away. At least they'll remember me for this piece. She looks almost sympathetic as she clicks her fingers, creating a large orange flame that dances in the palm of her hands. Not my manuscript. No, please. And as the crows drag my soul away from the shell of the body on the floor, I watch the pages burn.
You've just heard Devil's Ink by Mark Taus. And now, also from author Mark Taus, I present Golden Child. England, late October, 1986. He's got him. He's sure of it. Defeat is in his eyes.
You know you want to, Smithy. Come on.
I just don't know, Charlie. It's a good deal, but...
Do it then. Don't think about it. Thinking's for broken-hearted.
Smithy shakes his head and creases his forehead.
Huh? Never mind.
It seemed like a good play at the time, a line from one of his mum's favorite songs, but he needs to get the boy nodding, not shaking. Josh looks at his watch again. They've been at it for nearly 50 minutes and don't seem any closer.
Come on, guys. I've got to get home for tea.
Shut it, Josh. Charlie snaps. We're negotiating.
Jeez, all right.
Josh buries his chin into his neck.
They're only stickers.
Charlie readies himself to unleash at his friend, but thinks better of it.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Josh. See, Smithy, they're only stickers. And look, you're getting six of mine for one of yours.
He holds the glossy cards up like 10-pound notes and wafts them in his face.
Just think how much closer you'll be to filling the book.
Yeah, but mine's silver,
Smithy says, shifting his glance to his own watch.
Don't mean squat. There are as many out there as there are the others. It's just a myth.
Too much, damn it.
His dad said it's okay to skew the truth, but never offer an outright lie, and he sold 40 cars last month, so he knows what he's talking about. Smithy offers another shake of his head.
Mum's doing lasagna for tea. I'd best be getting home. She can fucking wait!
Both Smithy and Josh snap their head towards Charlie, and an awkward silence blankets the corner of the small playground.
Calm, Charlie. Calm.
Smithy, this is just about you and me. The planets have aligned so that we can do this deal.
I don't know, Charlie.
Fuck's sake, Josh mutters.
I'm only asking for Tunnel Stalker.
It's a silver, though.
Charlie feels the deal slipping away. It's time to go for broke. Pull out all the stops. No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Smithy, how are you ever going to get through life without making a decision?
The kid shrugs.
Smithy, this is a big moment, a coming-of-age thing. And to tell you the truth, you're fucking it up.
Josh does a 180 and kicks a tuft of grass, starting to feel bad for the kid.
Did you decide what to have for breakfast this morning?
Charlie says, leaning in. Smithy nods.
Did you decide where you'd sit on the school bus this morning?
Smithy nods again.
Did you decide what underwear you'd wear today?
Smithy shrugs.
Oh, Jesus.
Charlie reaches a hand to the kid's shoulder.
2 out of 3 ain't bad, but 3 out of 4 sounds better. What do you say, kid?
I'll sleep on it, Charlie. Talk to me tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Tomorrow the planets fall out of the sky, Smithy. Tomorrow might never come. Tomorrow is...
Nearly here,
Josh says, but regrets it instantly as he feels the sting against his neck. The acorn lands near his feet, and he boots it into the damp grass.
Tomorrow, Charlie.
Smithy gets up and slips the precious silver card back into the front sleeve of his album.
I've gotta go.
All right, fuck off, you prick.
He watches the kid make his way to the other side of the playground, album carefully tucked under his right arm.
Other people want these, though. You'll live to regret this, Smithy.
Mark my words, Josh mumbles under his breath. Thought you had him there, Charlie. Maybe you're losing your touch.
That was your fucking fault,
Charlie says, pushing himself up from the gravel and giving his pants an angry brush down.
How do you make that out?
I've got to go home for tea,
Charlie mimics in a less than favorable voice.
Do you think Richard Branson ever said that? Sorry, guys, I've got to put this $1 billion deal on ice because my chips are burning.
I guess not, Charlie, but I'm sure as shit Richard Branson picks out his own underwear.
Good point. He slides the cards carefully back into the little plastic wallet and into the album's inside sleeve.
God damn it, only 3 more and the book is full.
The pair begin making their way across the field towards Spencer Road, breathing in the scent of earthy mud and thinking about all the useless ways they can fill their evening.
Jono only needs 2 silvers. I can't let him beat me, Josh.
Man, you're obsessed. I've not seen you this excitable since Amy Winters asked you to stroke your dog.
Yeah, my hot dog.
They laugh until they have tears in their eyes, setting each other off again as they approach composure. Charlie even momentarily forgetting about the 2 silvers and gold. Only the sight of Richard Hoggins and crew near the corner shop throws a heavy blanket on their fire.
Shit.
Charlie stops dead, hoping they haven't seen him already.
Why does he hate you?
He hates everyone, just me that little bit more.
Charlie edges away, taking cover behind a large oak and driving his back against the bark.
I can't go that way, Josh. No way. If he gets hold of my stickers...
Mate, I have to get back. I'm already on a warning.
If he asks, tell him I'm already at home, yeah? Shit, I knew it was a bad idea bringing them with me.
Of course, Charlie. That's a hell of a long way round, though, isn't it?
Just go, Josh. From where they're standing, you're talking to a tree.
Okay. It's cool. See you tomorrow, yeah?
Yeah, just go.
Charlie gives it a few seconds before sticking his head out to see Josh approaching the road, head down, not running, but as good as. He hears one of the crew, possibly Richard himself, holler something, but traffic swallows any further exchange. For what seems like an eternity, he waits for them to leave, praying he won't need to go through Thorny Passage under the old railway line tunnel and finally through the field with the scarecrow and decrepit barn. Those types of experiences are for sharing, a ritual that conjures brave talking but also elevated heart rates and skin that crawls. But he's kidding himself. Those kids have nowhere to go, never will.
You've got this, Charlie.
He scoots behind the cover of the next tree.
Hate you, Smithy.
Another peek, but they're like smoking statues. He contemplates just waiting it out, but on the occasions when his dad forces him to help with food shopping, he's seen them there well past 7.
Shit on a stick.
His stomach stirs as he takes in a few breaths of earthiness mixed with cooking food. He'll be at least 30 minutes late. No silver card and a whole heap of shit from his parents. 3, 2, 1. The marshy ground gives underneath as he makes his run, backpack swinging wildly behind, sticker album tucked tightly under his right arm. He glances to the right, but so far, so good. Thorny Passage awaits only 30 yards ahead, but if they see him now, there's a good chance they'll follow, and that'll take things up a notch.
Come on!
Thoughts of the upcoming ordeal plague his mind, so he begins envisioning the blank spaces in his album to counteract. Tunnel Stalker, Mole Man, and Swamp Thing are all that stand between him and notoriety among his peers.
Tunnel Stalker. Fucking Tunnel Stalker. It had to be, didn't it?
Another glance to his right shows the crew is none the wiser. He slows his pace to a jog as he approaches the gravelly path, spiky tendrils like barbed wire fencing looming on the other side, along with the faded poster of the missing kid attached to the lamppost. He takes cover, turning to his side, ready to shimmy through.
Please leave. Please leave.
A last hopeful glance across, but realization dawns that he has no choice. Trying to avoid eye contact with the poor kid's face on the poster, he shakes off the backpack, unzips it, and carefully slides the album in. Okay, okay. Holding the pack tight to his chest, he breathes in and begins to sidestep, screwing his face up as thorns start pulling at his clothes and skin. A distant holler snaps his head around, and his stomach drops. Blood pounds in his ears as he holds his breath, but no voices. He carries on, shrugging off the spiky attackers and pulling the pack even tighter to his chest.
Fucking Smithy! Fucking Josh!
He misses his best friend already, though, each step taking him further into the bowels of the thorny beast. Ducking and weaving as best he can, the prickly vines seem intent on claiming him, and frustration finally sets in as his right foot gets tangled, quickly turning to pressure behind his eyes as he rips it away, catching the side of his cheek with a good one. He traces the wound with the index finger of his right hand and inspects the magnificent red against his paleness. Finally, bringing it to his lips, he finds himself wondering if he even took the right opening, if one day someone might stumble upon his remains, thorny tendrils emerging from the eye holes of his skull.
Fucking hell, Charlie, get a grip!
But he remains on the verge of tears until, through a gap in the thorns, he catches sight of the embankment and the rusty roof of the old makeshift station. The last of the vines latches onto his jumper, but he tears away easily and throws the backpack across his shoulders, ready for stage two, the climb. He takes a breath and begins his ascent, tufts of wet grass and the occasional clump of damp brown leaves making for a challenging scramble, but momentum carries him forward, that and the urgency to get home. Finally, at the top, he affords himself a few gulps of leafy air.
No going back now, Charlie.
He thinks about form class on Thursday morning and how well his story of bravery will go down, how he took the shady route home just for the hell of it. A gust of cool wind highlights the evidence on his face and serves as a prompt for him to stop crapping and get cracking. Tunnel next.
Okay, let's do this.
He lowers himself to the grassy decline, extends his toes, and digs his heels into the ground, shuffling his bum across a few inches at a time. It's a perfect system until his palm finds a semi-crusty pile of white dog shit hiding in a flurry of tall grass. He can hear Josh's laughter in his head.
What are the chances? He would say, or something along those lines.
There's a bittersweet feeling as Charlie wipes his hand on the grass. Dog poo. Dogs. He thinks about their German shepherd, Basil, waiting patiently at the window for his return. Easing himself down the rest of the hill, he notes how ominous the tunnel looks in the distance. Strangely longer, too, as if it's grown recently, along with the vegetation.
No going back.
He surveys the disused railway line. A case of nature meets humans, and nature is winning. Long grasses and vines work through gravel and spill over the rusty frames of the tracks, even beginning to swallow the brickwork of the tunnel ahead.
So damn dark in there.
He sets off, the urge to cry gone, but the hairs on his neck bristling their warning. The low sun causes him to squint on the approach, but he still notices the abundance of rabbits scampering and fleeing back to their homes.
Stranger danger.
He raises an arm as the glare worsens, but not before he catches sight of something glimmering from the tunnel's depths. Gone just as quick, though.
What was that?
Arching his neck, he searches again, but only finds fluffy gray floaters as the sun's rays hit him full on. Another chilly gust blows across as he squelches his eyes with the ball of his right hand. Temperatures dropping. Thoughts of being out here without sunlight spur him back into action, and he begins a jog towards the tunnel's opening. The plan is to sprint right through. Not overly complex, but at least it's a plan. He guesses he can do it in 20 seconds tops.
20 seconds, Charlie? That's nothing.
He reaches an arm out towards the brick and performs a futile series of stretches, noting the graffiti scrawled across the entrance. For a good time, call Charlie Davenport's mum.
That fucker!
he guesses the handiwork of Richard and his minions. Wrong number.
Still, that fucker.
Mid-limber, it catches his eye again. Something on the floor, just on the border of where dark meets light. He'll stick to the right, away from oblivion. 3. A couple of deep breaths of earthy dampness mixed with a tinge of stale urine. 2. He yanks a leg behind his back, just like on his mom's aerobic videos. 1.
Oh shit!
And he's off, arms and legs going like the clappers, and as close to the tunnel wall as he can get without being part of it. Coldness wraps around him, and the putrid cocktail on entry fades to something much worse, something he'll try and forget as soon as light washes over him. He hears gravel crunching under his shoes, but can't feel his legs. Darkness seems to be spilling towards him from the sides with each step. And what the fuck was that? He snaps his head to the left, but only a dark void awaits. Cold air stings his lungs as his arms swing by his side, more of a desperate clawing at the air than good form, as if trying to grab onto an invisible rope. Another glimmer.
No. No way!
He draws closer, a second wind, teeth digging into his lip, heart feeling dangerously close to exploding.
There's just no way!
But it's not a trick of the light after all.
A fucking silver!
Over the pounding blood in his ears and the clunk of steel as he dances across one of the rails, he thinks he hears a noise from behind, but a glance over his shoulder only finds unlit recesses. He snaps his head back around, eyes on the prize, but still unable to make it out. Preparing for collection, he stoops, knowing the odds are...
Tunnel Stalker!
Long and gangly limbs, skin almost translucent against contrastingly stringy black hair and menacing eyes, he knows the creature off by heart. He's envisioned the card so many times, as if he could somehow conjure it from thin air. With fingers stretched out, he lowers his arm to the ground, grimacing as he catches the sharpness of gravel, but not recoiling. And...
strike!
His fingers catch the edge, but he fumbles it, only managing to flick it over.
Shit!
He turns sharply, pushing his right foot against the semi-exposed wood.
Was that gravel crunching?
Something moves within, too. A shadow in a shadow. He saw it. He's sure of it.
Your imagination, Charlie. Suck it up.
There's an expelling of air as if someone is breathing.
It's just in your head, Charlie.
He wants to turn and sprint for the light, but he knows he'll burst with regret when he gets home.
A silver. Only two more after that.
Before he can talk himself out of it, he thrusts himself into darkness and swoops in again, focusing on the card and nothing else, ignoring the sounds that aren't really there, as he's the only one in the goddamn tunnel. Gravel crunches. Something breathes.
It's you, Charlie, you idiot!
His fingers meet glossiness and clamp down like a crocodile's bite. Another rasp. More grinding gravel. With a garbled war cry, he makes his run, almost toppling over, but momentum and sheer will somehow keep him up. He hears someone calling his name from behind, the voice raspy, rattly, the stuff of nightmares.
Charlie Davenport.
The feeling in his legs is back, but they only scream at him to stop as his feet fall heavier with each step.
So close, he can almost feel the sunlight on his face. It's in my head. It's in my head.
What about the breathing?
And you saw something move. A rat.
Must be a big fucker.
Light falls golden ahead, and it's a heavenly sight.
Home stretch.
Gritting his teeth, he sprints for his life, all technique out the window, limbs jerking like a marionette on speed.
In my head.
Gravel crunches. Something hot falls across his neck.
Mom's doing fish for tea.
He glances over his shoulder before letting himself crease over, sucking in urgent mouthfuls of freshness no longer tainted by,
in my head,
bad things. The tears are a surprise, but he lets them flow.
After all, he's pretty sure nobody's watching. Wisps of breath pepper the air as he shuffles off the backpack and flops to the damp grasses of the embankment. He made it through the tunnel, but its mouth looks no less foreboding.
Made it, though.
Light dances across the sticker as he holds his reward out in front. He angles it left and right, lending animation to the emaciated form of the tunnel stalker. The voice plays again in his head.
Charlie Davenport.
And he lets out an involuntary shudder. He pictures Josh's face, the captivated look in his best friend's eyes as he runs through his account of events. Maybe he'll believe him, maybe he won't, but the sticker sure as hell didn't drop from the sky. He takes the album from the pack and begins flicking through the pages, knowing where he'll find the blank space waiting. It feels like a big moment, far more significant than the placement of a card from a purchased pack. He earned this one, put his life on the line. Well, that sounds good in his head. Page 76. He carefully peels off the back layer, inhaling the pungent but gloriously familiar adhesive, and with a shaking hand, brings the silver trophy towards the page. The environment is usually much more controlled for the procedure, and he equates it to surgery. One wrong move, and there's no going back. But luck is on his side today, and it's a perfect placement. Two to go. Conscious of the time, he slips the album into his pack and gets to his feet, taking one last prideful look at the conquered tunnel. He gives it the middle finger and turns, beginning his trudge towards Scarecrow Field, the cool breeze accentuating his now damp behind, prompting a quickening of pace. There's undeniable trepidation of what lies ahead, but he's a tunnel beater, and he has a trophy to prove it. His legs feel springy again, and his heart rate begins to settle close to normal. In my head. A gust of iciness bites at his skin, and he buries his chin into his neck and folds his arms. The further he gets away from the tunnel, the more his mind wanders back to everyday things like being late home for tea, math's homework, Amy Winters, and the fact that Jono still has the edge, only needing two silvers. It's a long wait until pocket money day on Sunday, too. He can already see the kid's smug face as he parades around the school. Look, but don't touch. It will mean nothing then. All the deals, the extra homework, washing neighborhood cars, watching others chew on impossibly colorful candy. And the goddamned tunnel. All for nothing. He lifts his head to see a speck of a bird resting on top of the fence in the distance, just visible over the slight rise. On the other side of it, he knows the tracks veer off to the left, leading their way to where the next station used to stand, part of the golf course where his dad sometimes plays now. Halfway home, Charlie. He ups his tempo as the wind wraps around him. It's getting cold, and he's not dressed for it, his thin jumper offering little protection and the arse of his half-mast pants wet through. His nose feels like ice as he wipes a string of mucus away. Alternating between a march and a jog, he soon nears the edge of the field, and in the distance sees the Scarecrow's checkered black and yellow shirt flapping in the breeze, and behind it, the barn he and Josh joked was full of missing children. His feet finally leave the gravel and begin treading silently on grass that spills through the bottom of the rickety fence. He coils his fingers around the soft wood, surveying the path ahead, squinting into the low light that catches the moisture on the grass. A beautiful sight, if not for the fucking scarecrow. He plans his route carefully, eyes carving their way down the right side of the field past the ominous figure and back to the center, away from the pools of brown and that god-awful barn. Halfway, Charlie. The fence gives a little as he straddles it, but he safely drops to the other side, shoes sinking into softness. With a cursory shuffle of his backpack, he sets off, staying close to the fence and trying to avoid the boggier patches that become more abundant with every step. He picks his spots, pointing his toes like a ballerina one minute and taking fairy steps the next, eyes occasionally darting towards the hay-filled fucker with gravel for eyes. Paranoia, on this occasion, pays. Hardly able to believe it, he watches it lift against a small rise of grass as another blast of cutting wind rears up. He sees flashing black and yellow from peripheral vision, but his stare remains firmly fixed on the patch of ground 20 yards to his left and just short of a sizable puddle of brown. The wind cuts out, and the card falls back, silver side up. Swamp Thing! Momentarily, he can't move. He just stands there, mouth open, transfixed by the plant-based entity framed in glorious silver. He tests the ground ahead. Soft, but no worse than the path trodden so far. Already lowering himself to the ground in preparation, he edges forward again.
Nobody's going to believe me.
He takes two steps, moving stealthily like a big cat towards its prey, adrenaline coursing through his veins.
Just one more card after this.
His stomach growls. Fear, excitement, hunger, in a perfect storm.
Jono's face will be a picture.
Nearly within reach, he lets his foot come down, but the ground makes a squelching sound. He tries a different patch, but this time the brown liquid threatens to spill into his shoe.
Shit. Just got to rip the bandage off, as his mum says.
The thought fills him with sadness and a need to be home.
Fish for tea.
He readies himself, slapping his thighs as if to wake up his legs, and as another gust of wind peters out, he makes his move, scrambling forward, grimacing as cold and dirty water finds its way into his shoe. His heavy legs scream at him as he trudges into the murk, up to his ankles now. Left leg forward, and it plunges deep. Right leg forward, and a high-pitched squeal leaves his lips as cold and dirty water settles just below his kneecap.
Fuck, fuck, fuck!
He sees a bubble appear on the surface of the puddle ahead. Desperately, he tries to unplug his left leg, but it's stuck. He throws himself forward, fingers stretched out towards the sticker, but just as they brush against its edge, the wind whistles around him, sending shirt tails flapping and the silver card lifting. The sight of another bubble replacing the last sends him into a frenzy, clawing and pushing at the soft ground, brown water splashing either side.
Come on, come on!
He manages to rip his left leg free, and he takes the opportunity to reach for the card in the dying gust, continuing his earthworm squirms.
Yes!
Another bubble emerges on the brown surface, and something has him. Something's latched onto his right foot.
Imagination again, Charlie!
As his left leg slides redundantly behind in a futile effort to get traction, his hands slap against mud. A ripple in the water sparks even more aggressive struggling, but it's still locked tight.
Something's holding it. That's why, Charlie.
He fumbles at the straps of the backpack and swings it to the right, launching his upper half onto it and trying to wiggle loose. Another bubble replaces the last, far too quickly for his liking. He closes his eyes and envisions his leg coming free and...
Holy shit, it's working!
Thrashing his upper body left to right against marshy ground, he continues to inch forward, picturing himself running across the field to the safety of Anderson Road, waking up in a warm bed to the smell of pancakes, only needing one more sticker. He's out. Shoeless, but he's out. Launching his backpack ahead of him, a little further each time, he uses it to drag himself as far away from the puddle as possible. It's slow progress, but it's better than having limbs exposed underground. Finally, as he nears his visible footprints, exhausted and covered head to toe in mud but silver card spotless between his teeth, he scrambles desperately to his feet and begins his run down the right side of the field, legs leaden but still putting up one hell of a fight. He throws his backpack across his shoulders and sniffs back a string of snot that threatens to tarnish his trophy. Feet still squelching, but sinking a little less each step, he focuses on a small patch of grass ahead, but well short of the scary barn. Even as he notices movement to his left, probably the wind, He doesn't let himself turn, even as he hears something akin to splashing, likely my own damned feet. He keeps his gaze fixed on the circle of grass and his arms pumping, even as he hears the watery rasp of his name.
Charlie Davenport.
He doesn't succumb to the temptation for a nervous peek. He runs for his life, doing it justice until his body finally gives up and he doubles over, chugging on cold air and almost vomiting in the process.
In my head. In my head. In my stupid fucking head.
In almost the dead center of the field, standing in his nominated safe zone, chest heaving, and the silver card still between his teeth, Charlie turns back towards the large brown puddle to see nothing but his dirt-covered shoe sitting at the edge of its rim.
What the fuck? There's no way. There's just no way.
But he considers that in all the chaos, he just might not have seen it come out. He snaps the card from his mouth, lips aching from pinching around the card's glossiness, filled with relief as he's unable to find even a single tooth mark. To be sure, he lifts it to the evening rays, but the blurry white spotlight only offers a bulky mass of green vegetation and black holes for eyes that offer only emptiness. The watery gargle of his name, the splashing, the shoe near the puddle's rim, all in his head?
Charlie Davenport.
His body offers an exaggerated shudder above and beyond the persistent shivering, and he snaps his head back towards the puddle. Back to the barn, the puddle, the barn, the puddle.
Get a grip, Charlie.
He's beyond cold, clothes heavy with dirt too, but he can't wait for a second longer. As the grasses give once more to the blast of wind, Charlie presses his palm against the ground of his little haven, and satisfied he's not going to be sucked arse first into it, he takes a seat and unzips his pack. Another sweep of the field, and another, another, and he finally opens the book. Page 32. He knows it off by heart, and the ritual takes place. Unpeel, sniff, position, place.
Swamp Thing. Conquered.
He lets out a groan as he pushes himself to his feet, zipping the album back into his pack. Every part of him aches, and the chill is to his bones, not helped by the ever-increasing wind. But two fucking silvers. One last obstacle, the one with the missing kids chained up inside. It crosses his mind to run, but his legs have other ideas, and he decides to save his energy for when he draws level with the barn. Besides, no danger here. All in your mind, Charlie. He settles to a pace just above normal, his feet finding more solid ground, and as far as he can see, the path getting even clearer ahead. 20 minutes or so, and he'll be home. Late for tea, and inevitably there'll be a scolding, but that's just fine. He'll take it. One more card, Jono's face will melt. As the wind cuts across again, he can hardly feel his fingers, almost translucently white as he holds them out in front. He imagines holding them in front of the fire, and that slightly uncomfortable but welcome tingling as they
shit on a stick.
Sure that his eyes are playing tricks, he follows it to the ground because there's just no way. Even with his previous finds, even as the card lands on the tuft of grass face side up, and even as the last of the light shimmers across the brown hairs, he can't bring himself to believe there are only 20 yards between him and Mole Man. He's in the classroom, people climbing over each other to see, oohs and ahs and pats on the back and high fives, Amy Winters with a twinkle in her eye. And in comes Jono, his smile fading to a grimace as realization dawns. Finally, he exhales and begins his approach, skin crawling with excitement, all thoughts of children in the barn fading. 15 yards away, the wind gets up again, but the card lifts only slightly. His stomach growls, but he'll be home soon, eating fish and throwing Basil the scraps. The sound of a branch snapping underfoot catches him off guard, but the gold shimmer has him like a tractor beam, and it's only 10 yards from his grasp. His skin prickles as he imagines placing the final sticker in the album and being the envy of the school. He even starts running through a small speech in his head, but just as he gets to the part about the bubbling puddle, the ground begins to give.
Shit!
As pain explodes in his right leg, he lets out a pained squeal and crumples to his side, nursing his ankle. Teary eyes fall across the broken branches and tufts of grass that served as his trap, Mole Man resting on top, just slightly out of reach. From deeper within the darkness, Charlie hears breathing and
a squeal. In your mind, Charlie.
But this time, he doesn't buy his own bullshit. He gets to his elbows and pushes himself backwards, thrusting his legs alternately against the ground. Dim light falls through the opening above, but the dark tunnel ahead swallows most of it. More breathing. With eyes on the solitary star above, he drives back into the wall of mud, offering his cards to the gods in return for his safe passage. It must be nearly 10 feet back to the surface, and no way could he climb back up, even if he wasn't already exhausted and sporting a twisted ankle.
Help!
His voice is weak, and besides, there's nobody up there.
Help!
Something's coming. Another high-pitched screech emerges from the depths, the sound of something scraping, too.
Please, help!
He peers into the tunnel, warmth spreading across his thigh as he catches sight of the approaching silhouette, a huge, lumbering mass of darkness, the top of its head almost trailing across the ceiling.
Mum's doing fish for tea.
He snaps his stare towards the star and offers a final prayer, but only gets another squeal for his efforts. It finally comes into view, claws as sharp as knives carving lines into the muddy wall to its right, long snout twitching at the air in front. Short, dark fur covers most of the body that stands at least 7 feet tall. It has no nose or ears, as far as he can see, but huge eyes as black as space, and an elongated mouth almost as long as the snout that houses rows of razor-sharp teeth.
Charlie Davenport!
It squeals, what looks to be a child's backpack clasped in its left claw. Charlie pushes back against the wall again.
Help!
The creature offers another squeal, and Charlie helplessly watches as it begins sprinkling the contents of the pack on the ground. A small shoe, a hairbrush, a Rubik's Cube, candy bar wrappers, a Polaroid camera, and a host of other paraphernalia, most of which looked like they once belonged to
a kid like you, Charlie.
A large book is the last thing to drop, helped by the creature turning the pack inside out as it offers a series of excited squeals. It crouches, clumsily flicking the pages over.
Charlie Davenport!
Let me go, please. I'll tell no one. Promise.
So many children, perhaps a dozen photographs to each page, and the book so thick.
Please.
The tears begin, but he can see clearly enough as the creature flattens the sheet and starts tapping one of its blades in the center of the only golden frame. A light, monochrome version of himself smiles proudly from within, and beneath, in thick black ink, his name is printed in a strange font full of flicks and curls.
Smile!
The creature squeals, bringing the Polaroid to its face. The camera bathes Charlie in white light, capturing a boy at the height of fear, a kid who knows there'll be no intervention from the gods, no celebration, no fish for tea. No kiss from Amy Winters. No walking Basil tonight. As Mole Man wafts the print in the air, squealing with anticipation,
Charlie glances at the card sitting atop the branches and grass, his mind full of death, and one crazy thought that he can't shake. At least I was a gold.
That was Golden Child by Mark Taus. Mark Taus is an English award-winning horror writer living in Australia. He would sell his soul to the devil, or anyone buying, if it meant he could write full-time. Alas, he started very late in his journey, penning his first story since primary school at the ripe old age of 45. Since then, he's been published in over 200 journals and anthologies, had his work made into full theatrical audio productions on shows such as the No Sleep podcast, and has penned 15 novellas, including Mischief Night, Nana, Gone to the Dogs, 333, and Crows. Chasing the Dragon, his debut novel from Erie River Publishing, was released in March 2024. Well, listeners, even with three stories, this episode had to close out sometime. Thanks to Ron Reiki and Mark Taus for their contributions tonight, and also thanks to you, friends, for joining me on the old Horror Hill. Next week, we're going to be embarking on a longer story that will span two episodes, closing out on Halloween night. Be sure to tune in for that. And until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.